We shall try that one again. I think we're live. Yes, Happy New Year to Simon and to both of our listeners. I'm Steve McCabe. This is the podcast Crave, dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining me and Simon lately.
Yes, I hope you're sitting comfortably. This week, we can't not talk about the passing of David Bowie and chat about the man's last album, Black Star.
And in film, another death, that of a well-known film actor. Bowie was as well, I suppose. But this time we're talking about Alan Rickman, most recently well known as Professor Snape in the Harry Potter films. And also...
I took your line.
Now you can
How
it's all
dare
yours.
I?
It's all yours.
You can't get good help these days.
You really can't.
The film of the moment, which we're going to say, I guess it is The Revenant. It's been a big winner at the Golden Globes. It's got Oscar nominations to its name. Is it any good?
No.
We'll discuss that. Oh, we'll disagree on that then. Steve has also secured, I'm sure, sound, brilliant financial advice from The Big Short, the film about the GFC, global financial crisis.
Yes, I lived through it. I was there in Florida when it happened, so this was actually quite a terrifying film to watch. But we'll start off, usually we start with film, but I think this week, the passing of David Bowie probably demands our most immediate attention, don't you think?
I do. He releases an album called Black Star, and then he goes and dies on us. And then we learn he'd been suffering from liver cancer for a year and a half. So this album's been reanalyzed, bearing all that in mind. And, well, Steve, basically, I like it. In the same breath as I say that, I say it's music that, you know, it demands your attention, your patience. It's engaging your mind and your heart. It's not a piece of pure pop or anything remotely like that.
No, not in the slightest. I am, when I am a fan of David Bowie, and I'm not always, to be honest. He's good, but he's not wonderful, in my opinion. But when he was good, was when he was a glam rocker. I've always a weakness for that era of music anyway. And when I heard he died, I was reaching for things like Ziggy Stardust and Diamond Dogs. That's the David Bowie that I loved. And there was very little of that on Black Star.
Not at all. We should talk about the sound of this album, Steve. It was it was really interesting the path, the musical path he takes you on these songs, because several of them, there's only seven songs on the album. Several of them open with some really catchy drum beats, and you think, "Oh, this is developing into something, you know, something poppy." But it doesn't really take you there.
No.
Often it diverts into something which is quite freeform, almost jazzy, with all the saxophone going in there. It's not a tightly structured set of songs necessarily. Not a lot of guitar. The fantastic drumming. Lots of saxophone and string arrangements, and that sort of Middle Eastern sort of setting and sense in that big, long opening song, 10 minutes of this song called Black Star. So it's not the most accessible set of songs necessarily musically, but if you've been following Bowie in recent years, you wouldn't be surprised by that, I guess.
No, it's a very long time since he's even worried about accessibility, I think.
Yeah. But what about his voice? And knowing now that how he was ill with cancer, I thought, man, this guy can still sing and then some.
Well, he was 69 years old when he recorded this album, and it's definitely the sound of a 69-year-old man's voice. It's aged. It's absolutely aged. But I think it's got a richness and a maturity and a character to it that's not simply an old man being all gruff and whatever. There's warmth to it.
Yeah.
There really is. We're on dangerous ground here, because obviously, the moment we start finding bad things to say about this, we are going to be internet pariahs. You'll be very careful what you say. But I think, even setting aside the hagiographies and just being honest about a piece of music, it's challenging, but it's rewarding, I think, is the easiest way of summing it up.
Yeah, I think so. I felt I needed to take a deep breath, clear my mind, and just let this wash over me. And I really needed to listen to these songs several times to sort of really get a true sense of them. And lyrically, you said challenging. He's been challenging lyrically right through his career, hasn't he? And this is no different. It's, you know, that there's love and death going on in there. But in a lot of references, we now quite specifically about mortality and his mortality. But I'd be lying if I said I knew what every song was about line by line. I haven't worked it all out yet.
No, I almost wonder if he knew what every song was about line by line. And this is one of the dangers you can fall into. Is with an album as dense and as multi-layered as this, it's a Rorschach test.
It's a good way of putting it.
What do you choose to find in it? And obviously, now that we can map back onto these lyrics, and obviously the lyrics of Lazarus are the most obvious.
Yes.
When he sings about I'm in heaven, well, we assume that he is, obviously. We now map our new knowledge of what must have been going on, or even our assumptions. Very, very private, very, very closed individual. We assume we know what was going on in his life in the last 18 months.
Yes.
And then we're mapping back those assumptions onto the music and the lyrics that we're presented with. There's a lot of assumption going on, I think. But yes, it is fair to say that this was... I mean, it was a record he made knowing he was dying.
Yeah. And if there was any doubt, have you actually got the physical CD, Steve?
No, I haven't bought one of those things in years.
Yeah, right. So if you've got it, and I actually went out and bought it. There you are. I made an investment.
Good man.
So the cover is a white cover with a black star on
it.
On the back, the songs are listed in black lettering on a black background.
Okay.
And in the little booklet with lyrics, it's also black letters on a black background. And so the theme of death and passing is there, it right in front of you. And it's hard to read the lyrics, and maybe that's not an accident. And just quickly, because we could spend the whole half hour talking about David Bowie, but when you hear about the death of an artist like that, for me, I mean, I was a teenager in the 70s. You talked about Ziggy Stardust. I was 17 or 18 when I went to Western Springs to see him twice, actually. First in 1978, and then he came back in the big Let's Dance, much more commercially oriented tour in 83. That was the time, something like, no one even knows for sure, but something like 75 or 80,000 people apparently crammed into Western Springs Stadium, when it was regarded as being the biggest concert in Australasia at the time, and made it into the Guinness Book of World Records. So
they say, in fact, that concert has the largest audience ever as a proportion of the population of the country it was played in.
Oh, that would be true. Yeah. So you know, this guy, and I remember being at university at the time here in Auckland, and the university newspaper used to have its polls, and there were music magazines here in New Zealand, and for several years he was always voted the best male vocalist. I remember that. So he was really up there, and if you're a young impressionable teenager, he could really get a hold of your consciousness and made you think, oh, this guy knows something. He knows something I don't know, and I need to follow him.
Yes.
So I really felt like I've now lost a piece of my popular culture environment that I grew up with. That piece has now departed. It feels a bit sad.
I think there's a lot to be said about why it is that there's been the outpouring of grief for David Bowie that there might not be for many, many other musicians. I got to thinking about this, and it made me realise he's the first to go as an old man. The first of the big, big, always there, defined an era act to go as an old man. We've lost others in the past. John Lennon, obviously, is the first one that comes to mind because he's one of the first to go.
Yeah.
But he was a young man, and
yep.
he didn't die of being an old man. He was taken from us. Freddie Mercury did not die an old man. He died, and everyone said, "Oh, it was too soon. That wasn't right." No, but suddenly,
that's a good point.
But when George Harrison, I'd even say.
Yeah.
We lost as a young man. But look at everybody else who we're still waiting for people. I mean, Keith Richards is the obvious one to worry about. Either he's going to die tomorrow or he will never die. We're not quite sure which.
Dylan's still hanging around. He'll go soon.
Sooner or later. But these will now die as old men.
Yeah, Yeah.
But David Bowie was the first to die an old man, and it started. And I think people are terrified now that suddenly we've reached a stage where that generation, the musicians who were influential in ways that I don't think anybody has ever been before, are now starting to die off. And when John Lennon was murdered, that was so out of expectation that you could dismiss it as a random fluke.
Mm.
And you can say, but the rest will stay with us forever.
Yeah.
When Freddie Mercury died of AIDS, again, you could say this is exceptional, it's remarkable, he's a young man, the rest have still got decades ahead of them. David Bowie's just died at 69, he's just died as an old man.
Oh, gosh, mortality. Oh, dear.
I know, it stinks. I very, very carefully avoided raising the prospect of Bruce Springsteen dying because
I wasn't sure you
could handle the truth of that.
This is Crave. We're craving our mortality, but this is Crave. That Steve McCabe and Simon Mercier-Wicki were talking about entertainment. Now, if David Bowie was an older entertainer, you, Steve, have just been to see very much a younger bunch of musicians, I understand. I haven't even heard of them. Who are the 1975?
The 1975. Apparently they get their name, incidentally, from a diary that the singer Matthew Healy was given a while back, and apparently it's got some reference to something that Jacques Kerouac wrote about a date happening in the 1975, and he liked it, and the name stuck. So that apparently where the name came from. But yeah, I went to see these guys last night at Auckland Town Hall, and I don't remember the last time I felt quite so out of place. I was about anything between 2 and 3 times as old as a target demographic. Yep. I was decidedly more male than about 95% of the people in the room. Seriously, if in a room of a couple of thousand people, if there was 50 blokes there, and that includes the 4 on stage, I'd be surprised.
Right.
I have never heard screaming like it. Oh,
wow.
Yes. I was warned as I stood in the photography pit at the front of the stage with girls crushed up against the crash barrier. I was warned the noise is going to get bad. And when they came on stage, I couldn't hear the band.
So, again, I don't know much. I take it these are pop singers. Are they Brits, Americans? Where are they from?
They're from Wilmslow. It's a nice little leafy suburb just south of Manchester.
Okay. Your neck of the woods.
My neck. Well, I don't know. Wilmslow's a bit posh for me, mate.
Oh,
is it? But definitely, I'm aware of it. They are jangly, funky pop rock. Is probably. I mean, there were moments when I was thinking that they would like nothing more than to be in excess.
They were okay.
In fact, the singer looked like if you took Mark Bolan and Michael Hutchence and stuck them in a blender, that's basically what you'd pour out afterwards. Mm. Leather trousers, sequin jacket, big mop of curly hair. The funny thing was, he was actually quite embarrassing at times. He wanted the audience to listen to his sophisticated and profound pronouncements about the transient nature of music. And at one point, he actually told them, be quiet and listen to me, please.
Oh, dear.
And I'm thinking, they want to listen to you. They just don't want to listen to you talking, mate. Because once he started singing, I've never known a crowd know the words to every single song quite as well as this lot did. It was fantastic to watch.
Oh, wow. It was a cultural phenomenon then.
It was a cultural phenomenon. I'm too young to remember Beatlemania, so I'll take what little examples of it I can get.
Fair enough.
It was absolutely bizarre.
And you promptly went out and purchased their entire back catalogue?
No.
Okay. Have they got a back catalogue?
Yes, they have. And, you can keep it, quite frankly. I mean, I took my daughter, I'm in her with me, to see it. She's something of a fan. She quite likes them. I mean, they're not her favourite band by any stretch, but she's fond enough. But she remarked that the Town Hall was the wrong place to see them because the sound was so bad that she couldn't actually recognise some of the songs.
Oh, that's a shame. Big shame.
Not a good sign.
No.
So, yeah, I went and then I left.
I think we should leave it there.
I think we should.
Right, now let's turn to film. I have for some time been thinking, and I very much tantalised by the trailer. Steve, there's a film called The Revenant, which has been getting a lot of press time lately, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw that trailer. I thought, oh, this looks quite good, sort of frontier America. The look of it looked interesting. So I went to see it, and my expectations were high, which I try to avoid because I often end up just disappointing myself. But not in this case. For me, I thought it was visually just had a big wow, capital W, capital O, capital W. I thought it was captivating. I thought it was a bit long, but I really enjoyed it, even with its blood and its gore. And it's kind of basically a Western revenge story. That's pretty much what it's about, isn't it?
Pretty much. It's Western and it's revengey.
Revengey. That's in. Oh, like, can we use that again? Revengey.
We'll take it.
Yeah. So Leonardo DiCaprio plays Hugh Glass, who was a real scout back in the day. Who was leading guiding a bunch of trappers through 1830s America.
Yep.
They get attacked, and apparently the real Hugh Glass did get also attacked by a bear.
Yes.
I hope I'm not giving too much away here. Maybe I am, although it's been out for a little bit. Survived, and something terrible has happened to his family, which he needs to... He needs to seek out and wreak his revenge on one particular character, and it's all the story of the film is basically how he does that. But it's really set. There's sort of lots of stories written about how the cast were put through hell to make this film, and you kind of see it on screen, don't you?
You do indeed. And to be fair, I think it's reasonable the cast were put through hell because, well, frankly, so was the audience.
In a good way or not a good way?
I remain unconvinced that it was a good way.
Oh, okay, tell me why.
Where do we even start? I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio spends 2.5 hours searching in the snow for an Oscar.
Oh, lovely. Okay.
I hope he doesn't find one just on principle. You should not get an Oscar for spending an hour and a half going, because that's basically all he does. It is implausible beyond belief. The man spends half the film wearing sopping wet clothing after plunging himself into icy rivers, and yet somehow manages not to die of hypothermia. He's so weak from being savaged by a bear. I don't know about you, at one point I was thinking, you know, can the bear please come back and finish him off? He was so savaged by the bear that he could barely stand, and yet somehow, out of nowhere, we then see him wearing a bear pelt cape. Where this thing came from, we don't know. It's too implausible in so many places. I know it's meant to be theatrical and dramatic. It was wearying. It is apparently, how long is it now? It is
long.
156 yeah. minutes.
You're right. 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours. It was an hour too long. It was dragged out. It was tiresome. It was oppressive. It doesn't let up for a second. It is utterly, unremittingly grim and bleak. And after a while, I thought, please, just get him back to the camp or kill him off. At this point, I don't really care which.
Okay. All right. It's nice when we don't always agree on something. I didn't get that. I mean, when I go to see a film like this, you know, it's territory that's been traversed before, lots of westerns and blah blah blah. So okay, that's cool. And the idea of the man with no name was Clint Eastwood was doing these sort of things decades ago. But I just thought the look of the film was fantastic for me. I just thought this Iñárritu who won an Oscar for the Birdman last year, I thought he had a great eye, not only for the sweeping landscapes, but his some of the shots where he's sort of with a group of people running through the forest, the camera's off the shoulder. I thought that was really fantastic. It really took me into the environment. I thought the sound was great. You could hear the crackle and the branches underfoot and the wind through the trees, and the soundtrack, the music was, I thought, really nicely done. It was unremitting. It was brutal. I agree with you that at times it did stretch credibility. I agree with that. I won't disagree on that. But I did get drawn into it, Steve. I kind of put aside those things, and I'm not sure why. Here's the thing that struck me a little bit.
Go on.
There's a lot of, you know, there's quite a bit made of the mystical elements in this film. The Indian community and their affection for and love of the natural environment. And a couple of times it made me, just kind of made me think a little bit of, if you'd set a story like that in early New Zealand and the Maori were there having a role instead of North American Indians. And I kind of felt a little bit of a link in my mind with that, and maybe that kind of drew me into the film a little more. But I know what you're saying about DiCaprio. Yeah, there's a lot of time he doesn't actually say anything at all. He's just grumbling and mumbling. But, I don't know. I don't know if I'd see it again. Would I see it again? That's a question.
God, no.
I almost could. There you go.
You go see it for me, because you mentioned the issue with the Native Americans, and I'm sorry, but I all I was seeing was very, very patronizing noble savage depictions, because they're spiritual, because they're close to the land, because they're primitive, because they're savages. It's part of a very, very patronizing depiction of those people, which I wasn't very comfortable with. There was a lot of sort of hints at fever dreams that never really quite went anywhere. The whole thing didn't really hang together well enough for me, to the extent that I ended up noticing things I shouldn't have been noticing. Like, apparently DiCaprio did in fact grow his beard out for the film, because as you say, the director, what's his full name? Alejandro González Iñárritu, to give him his full name.
Yes.
He's dropped the González lately for reasonable reasons. But he apparently did put the cast through hell. Famously, the one scene where DiCaprio's character is fed from a bison.
Yes.
He did, in fact, apparently eat actual raw bison liver.
Sheesh.
Yeah, this is method acting taken possibly a step too far. So the whole thing was done very, very realistically. But I did notice that even though his hair and his beard were completely wild and all over the place, his moustache was cut very neatly straight across his upper lip. Take it from a beard wearer, that's not how it works. But I shouldn't have been noticing this. I shouldn't have been paying attention to the fact that at one point where we see him riding off on a horse being chased and he has to shoot people, his musket, which everyone else has to load one shot at a time, apparently carries three rounds.
Okay.
I shouldn't notice these things.
Yeah, I have to say I noticed that too. But and one other thing, while we're being in our little picky note, Steve, one point when he's, I think this might be after the noted attack by the bear.
Yes.
You see his foot terribly wrenched in the wrong angle, at a terrible angle.
Yes.
And I did note later on it had miraculously corrected itself. Whether that was under the care of an Indian, I'm not quite sure, but that, yeah.
There was a miraculous healing. It really was.
Yeah.
He recovered alarmingly well. But let's face it. Obviously, you know, these natives, these savages, they're very, very good at healing, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here's one of those rare examples where Steve and I are going to disagree on something. If you asked me, Steve McCabe, would I buy a ticket for this? I would say yes.
And I'd say I want my money back.
Right. Excellent. That's what we want in 2016. A bit of frisson. Now, hey, what about... there's another film. Can we just move on to something else?
I think we might need to, yes.
Yeah, I wanted to see this one. I haven't managed to do it this summer. You have The Big Short.
The Big Short. This I saw trailers for this and thought, I need to see this. And so when the press screening came around, I thought, I'm definitely there. I've got to see this. I lived through the global financial crisis in Florida in the mid-2000s. And so I watched this film thinking, oh dear God, yes, this is true. Every word of this rings true. I remember the offers from mortgage brokers to get me into million-dollar houses that I was nowhere in the world I could afford. And they said, oh, don't worry, we'll fudge everything. I hadn't realised quite how pervasive the corruption was. And I found the film absolutely fascinating. It starts with about 5 minutes of basically documentary-style exposition, because you do need a bit of background.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lovely gimmick that they use a couple of times when there are complex economical and commercial concepts that do need a bit of serious didactic exposition. They get celebrities in to do it. The very first one is quite wonderfully. It's Margot Robbie in a bubble bath.
Okay.
And they're so upfront about it. The director, Adam McKay, realizes that he has to get this device in somehow. So he actually has one of the characters turn to the camera and say, "This is complicated. So here to explain it is Margot Robbie in a bubble bath." They're very upfront about it. It's quite beautifully done. It takes a very, very complex and very ugly episode in American financial history and actually makes it accessible and very, very engaging to watch at the same time. It's not an easy trick to pull off. I mean, this again is a long film. It's well over 2 hours, but it is engaging. It's snappy. It's sharp. It's very, very well done. Largely due to three central performances. Christian Bale plays a chap named Michael Burry, who first realised what was going on and had the idea of shorting against the financial market, basically betting that it was going to collapse.
Right.
Everyone thought he was insane. Even his own financial backers said, "We have no faith in you whatsoever." I mean, Bale over eggs the pudding a little bit. I mean, it's obvious this guy's meant to be a social inadequate who's brilliant. He's slightly savantish. And obviously turns out that he was absolutely right, because the housing market did collapse quite horrendously. But in the meantime, we've also got Ryan Gosling as Jared Venet, who is another guy who overhears the plan to short the market, and then tries to sell it to Steve Carell's character Mark Baum, and these guys are the ones who are at the forefront of. Well, they were the ones. They were the voices crying out in the wilderness. Yeah. They were the prophets who were saying, "This is going to collapse any minute. It's going to. We know it is. We know it's fundamentally corrupt." Carell's the guy who, and this is based very closely on real people. Yeah. Carell's character Baum is the guy who actually challenges bank managers and leaders and says, "You do know, don't you, that these mortgage-backed securities that you're trying to sell are a house of cards, and any second now a stiff breeze is going to blow and the entire thing's going to collapse. You do know that, don't you?" And the answer he's getting back is, "We're sorted." It's nasty, but it's done in a very entertaining and very, very intelligent way. I would recommend this film very, very highly.
I shall go and see it. And if we get time next time, well, I'll give you my thoughts. But as you say, fantastic cast. And yeah, looks good.
And also, up for the Best Picture Oscar. I realise The Revenant stands a bloody good chance of getting it. I would put this, or I would put The Martian, way ahead of The Revenant.
Okay, all right.
Now, coming up shortly, it's worth mentioning.
Yes.
Speaking of Best Picture contenders, we will be looking next week at The Danish Girl.
This is the man who really is a woman, and looks incredible. Another amazing. It's Eddie Redmayne, isn't it? The actor.
Eddie Redmayne, yes.
Redmayne, beg your pardon.
Eddie Redmayne, who is in the running and is a plausible candidate for back-to-back best actor Oscars.
That would be. Who's done that? Tom Hanks is the one who's done it in recent times. Maybe he was the only previous one who ever did it.
I don't know any previous to Tom Hanks, but he's certainly one of our generation. He was the last guy to do it back in the 90s. He was Forrest Gump in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And I would love to see, frankly, anybody over...
DiCaprio.
Leonardo DiCaprio does not deserve it. I'm sorry. He's going to get it. There's your prediction right now.
I think he will.
Going to get it, because I think it's his fifth nomination.
Yeah,
and he'll get it, but he won't be getting it for The Revenant.
Okay. And The Hateful Eight is also out very, very soon. We'll be talking about that next time too.
Oh, can't wait for that one. Yeah, that's coming up there. Press screenings on Tuesday. I will be there for all 3 hours of it.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm not sure if I'm going to get to see the cut that's got an intermission in it, but apparently Quentin Tarantino has actually made his. He set it up so that it can be shown with a 15-minute intermission.
Oh,
in the
wonderful.
End.
Wonderful. That takes me back.
Jolly decent of him, if you ask me.
Yeah, nip out for an ice cream or some popcorn. Right.
Yes. Now, I understand that we have another let's not say an obituary, because that's an awfully miserable word. We have another eulogy to deliver.
Yeah, we do. An actor who died also this week, and also he was the same age as David Bowie, the British actor Alan Rickman, who he's played lots and lots of roles, but around the world he'd be most famously recognised as Professor Severus Snape from the Harry Potter films, in which he really, I thought, stole every scene he was in those films, that he just made it his own. I thought he was fantastic in that role.
Pretty effortless, really, wasn't
he? Yes, he does, I mean, exactly.
What can you do with I'm not going to attempt to imitate it. It would be a disgrace and an insult if I did. But what a wonderful voice he had.
Yeah.
What those people, you could recognise his voice a million miles away, and it's so singular and so distinctive that he made no attempt not to be Alan Rickman.
And thank goodness for that.
Indeed. But you mention Harry Potter, and obviously that's what he's most known for.
Yeah.
People have also been trotting out Love Actually, which was... It's a delightful film.
Okay.
And Die Hard gets mentioned repeatedly as well. But there is one that has to be mentioned, that has to be brought up if you're talking about Alan Rickman. And that's a film called Dogma.
Oh, and I've heard of Dogma but not seen it. Tell me.
Dogma is a bizarre film. It's from 1999. And it's a Kevin Smith film. I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Smith.
Clerks, how the Americans say it.
They like to think they can speak English. We speak English, we call it clerks.
Right.
But it's Kevin Smith. He wrote it, he directed it. I think basically Kevin Smith must have been raised Catholic, and this is his therapy for it. It's quite fantastic. And up alongside everyone from George Carlin to Matt Damon, the film's all over the place. But Alan Rickman plays the Metatron, the voice of God.
Ah, and what a voice. Okay.
What a voice. If that's the voice of God, then I'm afraid. I'm terrified to think that that's actually what God sounds like. But we'll go with it. If you want a tribute to Alan Rickman, get hold of a copy of Dogma. It's fantastic.
Oh, wonderful. And there was a farewell of a different type this week as well, Steve. One of the most popular British cultural exports in recent years, the television series Downton Abbey, which has had, I don't know how many years it's been going now, but its final episode screened in New Zealand just this week.
Yes.
Did you catch it?
Oh, I did. I caught it when it was broadcast in Britain. I saw it shortly after Christmas.
Okay.
Because I'm a bit of a fan.
I liked it initially, and I just got lost in the transmission, and I missed a few series, but... I don't know. I've always wondered about this because I grew up with New Zealand here in the 70s. We grew up with upstairs, downstairs.
Which is the obvious comparison, yes.
Yeah, and it's hard not to bear that in mind when you're watching Downton Abbey. I'm not British and you are, but I found that after a while I stopped caring a little bit about this upper class bunch of people. But maybe that just reflects my roots. But I mean, it was beautifully put together, wonderfully, you know, the settings and the costume. And there's a fantastic, fantastic line delivered by who else? Maggie Smith in that final episode, Steve. It's what I think I remember most, when they're trying to sort of look at what makes the English the English. And her co-actor says, oh, it must be our history. And Maggie Smith says, personally, I think it's the weather.
And she's probably right.
Yeah, I thought that was one. And she was fantastic. But, you're an Englishman. How does this resonate with you?
Well, obviously, this is the class system at its best.
Yeah.
And had I been brought up in that era, I'm fairly comfortable. I would have been downstairs, not up.
Right.
It's beautiful. It's utterly preposterous. It's nonsense. It was only ever going to be fluff. But it was extraordinarily expensive, brilliantly produced, very, very sumptuous fluff. And I used to love it. I mean, the one basic premise that not only did the one daughter run off with the chauffeur, but then the chauffeur is then welcomed back into the bosom of the family, I just found utterly, utterly preposterous. There were too many things like that that I just simply couldn't get on board with. They killed off characters almost Game of Thrones style. It was it was bizarre. There were random plot lines that would emerge and then disappear just at will. But at the heart of it all, there was actually a very real family with characters that you could actually like a little bit. And it was utter fluff.
Yeah, soap opera.
Yes, absolutely. Sumptuous, but a soap opera. But the thing is, any time you got Maggie Smith and Penelope Wilton in a room together, you think, that's it, I don't care about anything else. I just want to watch this. I would watch a spin-off just of those two gossiping. I would watch that all day. I can't get enough of those two. They are phenomenal together.
What an absolute master at delivering a line. Maggie Smith is, isn't she? Just fantastic.
And to be fair, Cousin Violet was the role I think she was pretty much born to play. Speaking of Maggie Smith, she's going to be getting discussed in much greater depth next week.
Ah, The Lady in the Van.
The Lady in the Van, Alan Bennett's memoir of a woman who lived, well, in a van. Oddly enough, you didn't see that one coming, did you?
No, very subtle title. Gosh, there's a lot of stuff that we've got to get our teeth into.
Blimey. Absolutely. Musically, we've got UB40 are in the middle of a Vineyard tour at the moment. I'll be seeing them up in Auckland tomorrow.
Ah, okay. And actually, in the next week or two, there's a... speaking of tours, it sort of happens this time of year, doesn't it, Steve? A very interesting mix of Huey Lewis and Melissa Etheridge are doing a tour around the country as well.
Yes, they are.
I might try and catch them in the Coromandel, hopefully.
They're going to be up in Fitianga over the long weekend.
Okay, very good. Well, I think it's not a bad start to 2016.
There's been some good stuff already. I'll let the listener decide about The Revenant. You and I are going to have to fight it out.
Yes. Well, that's good. Yeah, let's have some... I'll be interesting to hear what people have got to say. Maybe we can reflect back on that next time. So this has been Crave. What are we? We're a conglomerate.
You don't even know what we are.
We're
an existential crisis on the radio. There you go.
A corporation.
Absolutely.
And we talk about music and film and theatre and TV. And he is Steve McCabe.
And he is Simon Mercer.
And you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can figure that one out for yourself. Or on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Ah, it's all very complicated. Okay, we'll see you again.
That is what's been entertaining us this week. Now, where do I turn this thing off? There you go.